Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, your host. But not the only host, because we have med students with us. We have, to my left, we have Zeynep Demir.
Hello.
We have Allison Pletch.
Hello.
We have Eric Wilson.
Hello.
And we have Allison, whose last name escapes me for the moment.
Celine.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
That's terrible. First time joining us. I hope it will be... I hope my welcoming you by forgetting your name will mean that you come back in the future. Today, we're going to do something a little different than we've done in the past few shows. We're going to talk about what physicians can do, aside from practicing medicine, to make the world a better place, basically. Allison Pletch here took the lead on this, so I'm going to throw it over to you, Allison.
Sure, Dave. So what I was, what
I
got
like
me...
How she says that so like... Sure, Dave.
I practiced for 15 minutes in the mirror
today. And then
today.
I screwed it up. Go ahead.
Anyway, this past week, I read a couple news articles that didn't have anything to do with medicine directly, but that got me thinking about, you know, in my future career, if I come across such examples of, I'll get to the point in a second, you know, what would I do? What would be my role as a doctor? Do I have a role as a doctor to, I don't know, somehow participate in these examples? And so what are the examples? So I read two news articles that had to do with single mothers who, while away at work or at school, had their children, their school-aged children, taken away from them. And the consequences of that, taken away from them, I should be clear, by the government, by, I guess, Child Protective Services. Yeah. So someone had noticed that the children were alone, called the cops, and basically they came in and removed the children. And the consequences of that removal were so profound on the family. Some of the children suffered from sexual abuse, as well as exposure to substances while they were in the foster care system. And that's just one example of what the family sustained as a result of the intervention. And things like substance abuse, things like post-traumatic stress or child abuse, those are serious issues that physicians should be aware of when treating someone for any number of illnesses. And because the experience of, you know, being taken away from their family can impact health, I, as a future physician, should I be thinking about what my role is in something like, I don't know, the development of a national child care program, which, if one existed here, would prevent such problems as the ones that I read in the newspaper. So I don't know, I got to thinking a lot about the role that physicians play in activism, in efforts that have nothing to do clinically with the health of their patients, but have have everything to do with the health of their patients, but just not clinically.
Sort of an acknowledgement of, I mean, of the fact that, you know, physicians in our society have an elevated place, you know, I think, you know, they're looked upon with a certain amount of, you know, they have status.
Yeah, like a social currency or something like that.
Yeah, and so are you guys obligated to do something aside from, maybe not obligated, but is it a good idea for you guys to do something aside from practicing medicine to better the world that we live in?
Yeah, and that's just one example. There are others.
With great power comes great responsibility.
That's what Spider-Man taught me. And
Voltaire
I really
said that first. I just wanted to... looked it up.
Not Spider-Man's uncle.
I used the internet. No, it wasn't Uncle Ben. It was Voltaire. It was probably not Voltaire.
I don't think so.
Okay.
We never learned that in my French classes.
Anyway.
Yeah, so I wanted to sit down with my peers and talk about what they thought about physicians as activists and what roles should physicians kind of participate in, take time away from their clinical work, because, you know, even though it's not clinical work, what, you know, the work that they might do as activists, it does affect the health of their patient population. What do you guys think?
I mean, I think activism is a really important part of what a physician does, but I also see a role within the clinical setting for specifically the case of the children being taken away by Child Protective Services, taken away from their mothers. in that maybe pediatricians or family med physicians could be, if it's seen as kind of a big issue, especially in your population, you could almost educate parents on what can happen, if, you know, or what precautions to take, or when is it appropriate to start leaving your child alone at home. And I think that's really shifted a lot.
It's interesting. As a parent, I don't think there are rules anymore. I think you know, the general rule is don't leave your children alone. Ever. Your children must be under supervision at all times, and if they're not, you're being a bad parent. This has changed dramatically since even you guys were kids, and I'm easily twice as old as you guys. So, well, okay, not that much. But anyway, the point is that it's completely changed. There are some states with laws that say this is how old, and there are lots of states without laws. At least the in the case of the mother who, and we talked about this last time, didn't we?
I think after the recording.
Okay, yeah. So at least in the case of the woman who was working at McDonald's and left her 9-year-old to play in the park alone, mm-hmm. while she was at work, she lives in a state where there is no. I don't believe there is a law that says, you know, you can't do this, and yet, you know, some, I don't know, hopefully well-meaning adult called the police on her, and, you know, so we as parents don't know when that age is, and I doubt physicians know either.
I'm not saying they do, but it seems like if it's something of, you know, importance, or if you do know of a situation where the parent might be leaving their child alone, just to be like, hey, you know, it's your judgment as a parent, and of course you can't look from the outside and tell people what to do exactly, but just to inform them this sort of thing does happen sometimes. But I also wonder from the advocacy standpoint, if doctors started advocating for maybe a little bit less strict of rules, or the National Child Care Program would be the best option, but even advocating for like less strict of rules, and everybody say, oh, doctors want people to steal our children. And I think that gets back to Dave's point that it's really a societal issue.
It's so hard. And one of the things that we read in that article was that, you know, this, or one of the articles, I think, this hasn't come about because, you know, this has come about because society wants this. Okay? Society has elected people, has made these rules for whatever reason. They've, you know, media is probably responsible for a lot of the news that surrounds abductions and kids getting hurt and all this kind of stuff. And so we as a society have basically required this of our institutions. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
I think you're right. We want these things. I think that government, parents, and physicians all want the same thing, and that's the safety and well-being, the ensured safety and well-being of children. And I just don't know if these sort of rules, like, I mean, yeah, I agree. You know, really young children, I don't know what the line is, but they shouldn't be left unsupervised to some degree. But I just don't think that Child Protective Services stepping in is a way or a meaningful way of addressing the need for safety for children. I think that a more meaningful way of addressing that problem, or that desire, that want that people have, is the development of a national child care program. I think that beyond ensuring the safety of children, it would also help families, maybe help families better themselves economically, help themselves out of poverty. If they don't have to pay for very expensive child care, then that money can be used, put back into family development.
Sure.
And poverty, as we all, I think, can agree, is a factor that deeply impacts the health of families. So I really can see, even though childcare has, like, doesn't seem like to have much to do with clinical work, the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced that this is would be a worthwhile effort for physicians to engage in on a policy level or on a lobbying level. Nothing in the clinic, but yeah, kind of something that would be worthwhile to do outside the clinic.
So what other opportunities did you guys think or read about this week? Anybody? Well, you had another one.
Sure. Okay, we can talk about food in America. A lot of my peers have begun rotating, and they're working in clinics now that are seeing patients with a lot of chronic diseases that have to do with being overweight in general. Ali, would you like to talk a little bit about your experience so far?
Sure, yeah. This is something that we, Allison and I, actually talked about yesterday a little bit, preparing for this recording. And I just got out of my community-based primary care rotation, which was largely family medicine. And yeah, I felt like almost the vast majority of patients that we ended up seeing were majorly affected by, or their disease was exacerbated by a poor diet, where we would see diabetic patients who were diabetic because they were overweight. We would see a lot of people with hypertension who were, you know, partially that way because of a high salt diet. Or we would see people with back pain because they carried too much weight in their abdomen, or they had osteoarthritis, and, you know, the list goes on, where we were seeing so many patients that were just affected by their weight.
And if we zoom out a little bit, why do they eat the way that they eat? I don't know if I can make this leap, but I was looking online and I saw this figure that showed the proportion of spending that the government allots in subsidies to different types of food groups. And less than 1% of that money is allotted to fruits and vegetables. And like 40% of government subsidies for foods is for dairy and meat. And that doesn't seem to make sense to me at all. And as a future physician, I think that is a great opportunity to jump in and maybe lobby for a change in how governments spend the subsidies that they give to the food industry. Make fruits and vegetables more subsidized, make them less expensive for patients to purchase, and perhaps we would see changes in health that Allie has been observing on her rotations.
While I agree that I think lobbying and pushing for these changes is a great idea, similar to tobacco industry and alcohol industry, the food industry has certain powers. There's a reason why the dairy meat industry ones that get these great subsidies. So I think
it's a complicated problem.
Right, I think a lot of this, it's all true and it all needs attention, but it's a systems problem. Yeah. And the systems problem, I think, both needs to be addressed from like physicians lobbying for the welfare of health, but also from the backbones, from behind the curtain, where all this money and all this power is fueling all of these. If you go spend some time on Capitol Hill, you'll see it. You know, you'll see this.
I've been watching House of Cards.
Oh, so you're an expert.
So, wow. I mean,
well, it's interesting too. I was thinking about physicians and politics, and so I went to the Patients Action Network website, which lists the members of the House and Senate who are physicians. There are 17 members of the House who are physicians, four of which are Democrats and the rest are Republicans. There are all three physician members of the U.S. Senate are Republicans. I don't know that I can reliably say that, well, it's, you know, the Republicans' fault or the Democrats' fault or anything like that. But I think that there's an opportunity there that socially aware physicians can get involved in politics. And maybe it's just right now. What I didn't do was go back and look through the other Congresses, because we had, right now, you know, there's a lot of Republicans in power. But I just thought that was interesting. You know, there's maybe a gap there that could be filled politically. And then you could use that to do what you can within the system to promote these ideas.
I think this could be a topic for another show, but the idea that you can be a physician and impact the lives of people, which is a fundamental reason why many people go into med school, but not do clinical work, is kind of cool. That your talent, you know, whatever you bring to the table as a physician is are skills that are relevant to many different, you know, fields.
Yeah, I mean, being a physician teaches you so many things. I mean, it also gives you the opportunity to see problems that need to be addressed, like the one you're mentioning with childcare. I think one of the, you know, we talked at great length last time about Dr. Oz and his ilk. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, I'm totally letting my bias show.
No judgment.
No judgment, Dr. Oz. But anyway, you know, there's a big, I think there's a big opportunity for doctor/journalist. Did you find anything about?
Yeah, I read an article, kind of more of an editorial written by a physician who's currently working in Gaza. And his role as a physician in Gaza is to do primarily clinical work, disaster management, really. He's utterly horrified by what he's witnessing in terms of morbidity and mortality in the area, especially among children. and he took it upon himself to write an editorial. I forget what paper it was printed in, but I don't think it was a U.S. paper, except it was addressed to Obama.
It was the Independent.
Okay.
And wasn't that it?
Yeah.
Or that was the article that you sent me anyway.
Well, I think it was a British paper, but addressed to Obama, asking him, pleading him to do something about this because, you know, the carnage that he's witnessing there firsthand needs to stop. And that's definitely another opportunity, I think, for physicians to different work. I mean, many people are blogging and, you know, recording what they're witnessing in Gaza. Many people on Facebook, I can't go on my Facebook wall without many posts about what's going on there. Are those posts getting national attention? Not really. And that might be because it's just, you know, an individual, a citizen. But this physician gets his letter published in, you know, an internationally known newspaper. And that's partly because I think he is a physician. Like I said, or like you mentioned earlier, he has a kind of clout that maybe the average Joe might not. And should physicians, I mean, accept that, be aware of it, and use it when they feel that they need to?
I think that really gets to one of the best ways to try to address problems that you see that you feel passionate about is really writing these op-ed pieces and submitting them to newspapers, magazines, anywhere, essentially. Actually, at the last Exam in Life conference, plug, Dr. Louise Aronson from UCSF.
ExaminLifeConference.com.
She gave a great talk on writing an op-ed and how she teaches a writing class at UCSF for residents about how to write an op-ed and how successful they'd been in the end if they kind of got the style down, and a lot of them end up getting published in like New York Times and stuff. And so if you have something you're passionate about, a problem that you can see, that's really, you have to reach out to the people, kind of to the masses. Otherwise, going through like the lobbyist route, you have the lobbyists opposing right. you. But if you can convince the general public that they shouldn't support the meat and dairy industry as much until subsidies are reduced, then you can start to have some power. But
I have another example of reaching out through the media. From India, Dr. Mahinder Watsa is a 90-year-old sex expert. Did you see this one?
I did.
90-year-old sex expert who has made it his mission, I think, for the past 50 years, maybe a little less than 50 years, but he's been a columnist for 50 years. And his mission is to educate India about sex. And India, sex education is a pretty controversial subject in India. So, I mean, he's had this column where he basically answers people's wacky, what we would think of as wacky questions about sex. I mean, this is huge, mm-hmm. If you think about it, because sex is such an important part of being a human being. And, you know, people are asking questions like, you know, I've heard that any kind of acidic substance can prevent pregnancy. Can I pour some drops of lemon or orange juice in my girlfriend's vagina after intercourse? Will it harm her? Mm-hmm. And basically he's like, yeah, might not want to do that. Sort of thing, you know. Like, I mean, this is a big deal. He's providing a service. This is a little different, but Reddit recently featured a discussion on the weird things that your body does that you've noticed but have never said anything about. You know, things like, you know, how you can make this weird rumbling noise in your ears without moving your face. And I can do that, and I've never really wondered about it.
Weird rumbling noise in your ears.
In your ears. Not basically, familiar. You're flexing.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you're flexing the inner, the muscles that attach to your, I don't know what the real names are called, the stapes.
No and way. Yeah, I can't do that.
Is
that
like, or something.
Is that like rolling your tongue? Like you have like this.
Maybe it is.
That lets you do it.
Maybe it is. I don't know, but there's like this whole series. Like this is, I mean, that's a little more frivolous, but it's, you know, doctors responding to questions, you know, elucidating the mysteries of the human body, that's a useful endeavor, I think.
Yeah, actually, on the note of using social media as a means of connecting with people, that reminds me of something that Ali and I, again, we were recently talking about, how we feel like there's a lot of debate about whether, again, I'm sorry to bring this can of worms up, but how vaccines may or may not cause...
I think we're going to rename the show The Vaccine.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's just show. Such a rich example for so many things. how it's such a all right, so vaccines, you know, causing autism or other illnesses in children. And we were talking about that, how frustrating it is, and how, yes, individual physicians are encouraged to engage their patients and their parents in discussion about this. But there doesn't seem to be an organized response from any larger medical body countering these claims that are made. I mean, there was one of the articles that I read was Katie Couric bringing physicians on her show to talk about the HPV vaccine, how she somehow got certain physicians to emphasize the how unsure we are as to whether it's effective, which is not what I feel the message that I was taught in class. I mean, vaccinate little girls and little boys, you know, start when they're young and vaccinate them. And I just got like...
It's probably a case of cherry picking your sources.
Sure, yeah. But there's no response to that. Her show reaches a huge audience. And what's the effect of getting mixed messages about whether or not vaccines are good or healthy? You get these outbreaks of measles and crew and things that are anachronisms, essentially, in our day and age.
You're saying the doctors and maybe national medical associations should probably step up and say, you know...
Okay, yeah.
And whoa, now I'm going to have to go and get rid of that.
I feel like a lot of this is also related to, though, the way the medical education system is designed right now, right? We are designed to, like, not stop and think for... Once you enter into med school, let's say you finish everything on time, you got 4 years of med school and at least 3 years of residency, yeah? That's, like, 7 years of... really not stopping and thinking, like, what can I do with this? How can I affect as many people as I can with this, right? Because we're concerned about, you know, all the tests we have to take, the applications, the residency programs, doing everything as we're supposed to. But then, like, the show you're talking about, you know, they reach, like, masses like that. Mm-hmm. No problem. And so I think some of it is, too, changing the education system of physicians and encouraging them to actually, like, along the way, stop and look outside the box of, you know, how can I use all of these resources that I am gathering throughout the years to help people in different ways?
Yeah, my guess is that in most medical schools, it's exactly that way. And you're sort of left to, after your training is complete, after you've got a whole bunch of life skills under your belt, to go, hey.
Now what do I do?
What do I, you know, what can I do with all this?
Right. Yeah, I definitely think that on an individual, like, patient-per-patient basis, physicians need to be having, you know, informative conversations about things like vaccines or interventions that remain controversial to the public, not controversial within the medical community. Sorry, you're going to say something?
I was kind of curious to hear what you guys would have to say about the distinction between the role of a physician and someone who has, say, a master's in public health. Because sometimes I feel like those are two different roles that a physician, even though they might have more, like, some power to say something about public health and have their message respected as a physician, that their role, at least in our training, is to see people in clinic, and then it might be more somebody's job in public health to say something about these larger health issues, like vaccines.
Yeah, I don't think that these issues should be addressed by one particular person. The more people engaged in solutions, I think, the better. My argument for why physicians in particular would make really good people to do this is because of the relationships that they build with their patients. I don't really have a relationship on any level with my, you know, the guy with the MPH who lives down the street from me. We don't have any kind of chance to interface professionally, or we do professionally, I guess. But what I mean is, like, there's no similar or analogous patient-doctor relationships between people in.
If you're studying, say, you know, outbreaks and, you know, this disease or whatever, you're not building that relationship with necessarily a human being, I think.
And I think that is maybe part of the foundation for the clout that physicians have. When they say something, it's because it's based on a history of relationships with people that that I think people accept. But by all means, as a physician, I can't do the research that, I mean, I could, but maybe I don't want to choose to do the research that people who with MPHs do.
And medicine is a very collaborative endeavor these days anyway. I mean, why not team up with MPHs and all kinds of people to sort of get the message out, right?
Yeah. My like utopian dream is to have all of these health professionals or people involved in health on some level, mm-hmm. you know, pool their collective resources, their great brains, their motivation to address these issues in well-researched ways.
And with and among all of those people, there's bound to be at least one with good hair who, you know, can be the spokesperson for the group and go on Katie Couric and say, no, stupid.
Listen, Katie.
Listen, yes.
Don't make me take my earrings off, okay? Because I will when it comes to vaccines.
What about physician entrepreneurs? So I was reading about... I was reading about Michael Abramoff. Oh, I can't believe I pulled that out. Michael Abramoff is a professor of ophthalmology here, and he has formed a company called IDX, which, you know, he tried initially to run as a nonprofit because he figured out a way, he and his group figured out a way to use inexpensive cameras to take pictures of the backs of people's eyes to detect diabetic retinopathy, right? So before this, you had to, basically an Iowan had to travel to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics to have their image read by somebody who knew what they were doing, somebody with very specialized training in ophthalmology to detect whether or not they had diabetic retinopathy. 80% of people with diabetes are going to develop this blindness, but it doesn't happen, you know, it doesn't happen right away. It takes a while. So they basically have to come back to UIHC to get their images read, and eventually, and they keep coming back year after year, and eventually they're like, well, I'm not going to do this anymore, and they don't come back. And then finally they develop it and it's too late to intervene. It's something that can be intervened and fixed, but, you know, by that point it's too late. So he developed a system basically a way to distribute to clinics in rural areas these cameras that would, coupled with software, basically provide them with a number. This person has diabetic retinopathy, or this person is developing diabetic retinopathy. You know, so basically it distributed that, telemedicine distributed that duty. And so he's put together this this company, which I think is cool. It's a worthy endeavor. He tried to do it as a nonprofit, but nobody wanted to fund it. Mm-hmm. In part because, you know, FDA certification is complicated, time-consuming, costs a lot of money, all that kind of stuff. And so people were like, no, I'm not going to invest in that. So he had to form this for-profit company. Now he has investors and all this kind of stuff. Just this past May, his device has been certified in the EU, still working on FDA certification. They get all the cool stuff in Europe first. So I think that's cool. You know, there, and as I said before, as physicians, I imagine you're going to encounter problems all the time with systems, with people that you might be able to address if you have the wherewithal.
Yeah, actually, Allie and I can both speak about one example in particular. We had a housemate who is currently taking a year off of school because he felt that he identified a problem that wasn't being addressed. So he's another medical student, and he wants to work on smoking cessation. And what he identified as a problem was that a lot of the smoking aids that are currently FDA approved, like Nicorette or other, you know, nicotine-containing things, they address the physical dependence on cigarettes, but they don't necessarily address the psychological dependence on cigarettes. Something that his name's Drew Park. Something that Drew was telling me was that, you know, there's something ritualistic about putting your pack of smokes on the spot where you always put them when you come home from work, or having them in your hand as you're outside taking a cigarette break, feeling one tucked behind your ear. These things are factors that add into psychological dependence, and they're not addressed when you try to quit smoking with something like, say, Nicorette gum. So he's actually like totally going for it. He's got this idea of a Q cigarette, and he's gone a long way with developing this this new idea. And it's essentially like a cigarette prosthetic that has a piece of chewing gum in it, and you bite off the chewing gum, and then you hold the cigarette prosthetic. It looks just like a cigarette. It comes in cigarette boxes, like cigarette looks like a Marlboro box or something like that. You can put it behind your ear because it looks just like a cigarette. You can hold it as you're, you know, chewing the gum. And I think that is this is a great example of someone who's in the medical field who identified a problem and is trying to develop an idea to address it.
Yes.
I know, Allie, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a really bold and, in my opinion, an admirable move for him to make, to act on something that he felt passionate about and to risk his time and monetary investment in developing this idea. I think it's really admirable, but at the same time, I think it is a really tough and risky thing to do. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, I talked to him about, you know, what I would do if I was in his place. He kind of wanted more opinions about where he was going with this project. And I don't know what I would have done in his position.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, entrepreneurship for sure is not for someone who's unsure. You gotta go for it with all your heart. And I think that's what he's doing. And I think that there are definitely, I haven't personally found one yet, but maybe you have in your rotations, like an opportunity for an idea that could be developed that could help, well, you know, patients.
Preparation, no, what is it? What's the saying? It's like,
something about
luck favors the prepared mind or something like that. She's totally thinking of another.
Luck is opportunity plus preparation.
Luck is an opportunity when planning meets opportunity.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
We all came up with like five different sayings.
Luck is, I think, opportunity meets preparation.
Yeah.
Right. So keep your eyes open, right? Keep your eyes open for these opportunities.
For sure, man.
And I guess, you know, these are probably all great ways to, I don't know if these are all great ways to avoid burnout, because we all know that that's a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounds like, for instance, becoming a physician entrepreneur is like a huge deal. You know, like, it's definitely not the way to relax. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But if it brings passion back to your life,
right.
If it brings,
mm-hmm.
you know, if it brings you a sense of purpose that you didn't have before, man, go for it, you know? I was reading this, speaking of burnout, the other thing I was reading was this this nurse. I'll put the links in the show notes to a lot of these things, by the way. But this this particular nurse... She was a post anesthesia care unit nurse, and you know, she was saying, you know, she was burnt out. It's stressful. People, you know, going into cardiac arrest. It's noisy. I never really thought of these places as being particularly noisy, but there's, you know, there's a lot of equipment noise. There's a lot of, you know, I don't know what hospital did she work? Is this real?
What?
Do you guys have any experience in PACUs?
Nope.
Not yet.
Nope. Well, it sounds like you should probably avoid it, but, you know, the way she was saying. But basically, she quit and became a medical writer. So she writes for, you know, WebMD. She writes for, you know, insurance companies, for, you know, various organizations that need writers for medicine. And she's like, this is awesome, you know. Yeah, writing is hard. It's mentally exhausting, but I have a life that I can, you know, and she's passionate about it. And she says she reaches way more people than she ever could as a practicing nurse. I'm not advocating giving up your medical career, you know, for something else, but it's a way to use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've burnt out, just me talking.
And I mean, that's the other thing that I think inevitably we're going to have to address, because I mean, we talk about burnout, right? We get like classes first week, all week long. They talk to us about burnout, about stress, how to avoid it. Yet the lifestyle we're expected to live is one in which you can't really avoid burnout. Some people burn out quicker than others. Ultimately, most people get to a point where they're questioning medicine. They've lost their passion.
I think it's just a fact of life, you know, with no matter what you do, you know.
True. But I think that this might be one avenue that gets you to that point a little bit more quickly. Because, I mean, let's face it, like the first 2 years, right? I mean, we all talk about it nonchalantly, like, oh, it was so terrible. But, I mean, we're healthcare professionals. We're going to be healthcare professionals. I think it's, you know, it's valid to stop and question for a minute. Like, what is the purpose of putting people who are supposed to help other people through the ringer in that way? I don't know. I mean, maybe there is a purpose that I'm like failing to see. I'm not sure. But
trial by fire, tempering.
You know, I think the medical education is really getting to a point we're going to have to look at some options here. You know, there's doctor shortages everywhere, and the amount of money that's being charged in this country for medicine, and yes, I know this is a very risky area to step into, but it's something to question, you know, like, because it's a way that a lot of people get locked into it. They're unhappy, they're burnt out, they're, you know, supposed to perform very well and help other people. But how do you do that within the midst of, you know, lack of mental health? And I don't know, I mean, I think that it's an important point to address.
I think as future physicians, you are uniquely positioned. Okay, so everybody always says, find your passion, right? For most of us, that's probably, I mean, that's good advice maybe, but I don't think it's very realistic. For physicians, you may be uniquely positioned to find your passion and use it for the betterment of mankind, or humankind, sorry. Every week, R2-D2 shows up. Sorry. You may be uniquely positioned to do something with your knowledge, with your passion, whatever you find, and it could benefit you, it could benefit everybody. You know, am I saying anything that makes sense?
You are. I actually want you to elaborate on this, being in a unique position to find your passion.
Well, I mean, the reason I think you're in a unique position is because, you know, of course, after you pay off your medical school debts, you may be in a position to make a fair amount of money, even if it's not like, you know, dean of the College of Medicine money or whatever, or, you know, but you're in a position to, you know, maybe use that for something, or use your knowledge, because you're going to have an awful lot of knowledge. You're going to accumulate an awful lot of knowledge eventually, whether it's societal knowledge, whether it's knowledge of, you know, what people are like, whether it's knowledge of medicine in particular. Many of the rest of us, you know, we work in a different world, I think. You know, like, so I'm a clerk at the College of Medicine, which I find very rewarding, and yet I'm not sure that I can turn that around. I haven't figured out a way to turn that around into some passionate, you know, oh, I'm going to revolutionize what?
But then the question is, do you find passion through education,
what
I mean? Like, yes, education can help locate a passion, perhaps it's a tool, but I feel like a passion is something that through one way or another you encounter in life. I mean, some people, I guess, maybe are just born with it. They just have it. They have it, you know. But I feel like you can encounter anything that evokes a kind of passion in you, right? So I'm not so sure. I think education gives you resources that if you found the passion, that will allow you to, like, continue pursuing it.
Yes.
Or maybe...
I think that's where I'm going.
In the avenue.
Yeah.
You find it. I don't know. But I just...
I think, I don't mean to cut you off or anything, but I think one thing that you might have been bringing up before was that our education system currently almost in some ways prevents us from finding other passions, because we are so driven to perform on exams that we have very little time to enjoy what we're doing and to explore.
Yes.
And I feel like if you are to kind of like go off the path and explore, you're really shut down pretty quickly. You know, you're told, what are you doing? You have a purpose. You're supposed to do, you know, and I feel like exploration of passion at times needs room. Yeah?
Well, we have a colleague who is bucking that trend even as we speak. She's been given time out to go and pursue her MFA in writing.
Yes.
Which I think is an amazing opportunity. I think it's amazing. I think it's great that that places like the College of Medicine at Iowa here allow that sort of thing to happen. I mean,
She's also one person though who she has that passion.
Yes.
Right? That passion. She knows her passion and she just goes after it.
Yes.
Which is equally admirable.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes that's what it's all about. I mean, you can't just go up to somebody and say, hey, can I?
Right.
Can I do that? You have to, like,
push for
you know,
it yourself.
Fight for
right.
it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, Yeah, same with our friend that we mentioned earlier. He was given permission to pursue this passion of his as well with, you know, addressing cigarettes and cessation and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Go out there and look for it. You'll find it, I hope. I want to thank you guys for joining me today in the Bullware community.
It was a pleasure.
Always have fun.
Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening.
But what I see's a child. Your eyes, your eyes.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.